people who love them.
Hello, this is The Thing About Cars coming to you from Strongbox West in Atlanta, Georgia. We have around the tables most of our usual players. Let's do quick introductions.
Eric.
Becca.
Ronnie.
Ben.
And I am Mickey. On the board, we've got three, maybe four quick topics that we want to just tackle for the time for the day. Ben has a traveling job, and so he's got some observations to make about the car rental world, specifically around one company. We'll get to that in a minute. I have a question related to turbochargers. Ronnie wants to talk about appreciating your mechanic, and Becca has a fuse problem with her G8. And if we can get that far, let's just go with that. But Ben, you travel a lot, so you drive a lot of different cars, and...
Yeah, well, let's see. I spend a lot of time in rental cars, one or two of them per week, depending on what I'm doing. And my employer has a contract with the National Alamo Enterprise Group. I get a contract number that I put in when I, you know, rent one, and so it includes insurance and it gets us a discount and things like that. So, well, we've got several locations around town. If I'm not picking one up at an airport, my wife doesn't like driving down to the Alamo location about 20 miles from us. She doesn't like the traffic down that part of town. We have found there are two Enterprises up near us, easier and quicker to get to, but my God, they're craptastic. I don't mean to, you know, badmouth, you know, companies outright, but their cars always smell dirty. They're much higher mileage than what I get from their corporate siblings. In fact, I had to laugh at this because the Alamo location changed their hours. They shortened their hours. They said, well, it's to match the Enterprise locations we trade cars with. Really? Because the Alamo location always gives me low mileage, fairly new cars. And Enterprise always gives me very dirty old cars. In fact, the one I had this last week was a Hyundai with 36,000 miles on it, smelled filthy. And they knew I was driving all over a couple states, and yet they gave me a car with no cruise control.
My first thought is that Enterprise does something that other companies don't do.
What's that?
But before I get into that, I do want to say that I've had sort of the opposite experience. Whenever I call around to look for rental cars and rental car rates, Enterprise almost always beats the competition.
Yeah, they're good on price.
They're good on price. I've never had a car that really smelled bad. I've had cars that looked kind of bad, and this brings me to the point that I was withholding for a minute, because Enterprise does typically not hire somebody to actually wash and vacuum and clean out their cars. I've been to an Enterprise where they flat out told me that they would reimburse me for any monies that I spent on doing that to the car. So they're basically passing off that expense to the driver if the driver cares.
The Alamo location is the opposite. They've actually told me, well, can you wait a few minutes? We're cleaning the car.
Right.
And it comes out nice and sparkly and fresh.
And if I wanted to, I could drive my car to a detail shop and have them detail the whole thing for $100, and Enterprise would probably just hand me a check for $100.
No, I've had rental cars from them going back more than 15 years in multiple states, and every single one has smelled filthy.
So you don't have very strong feelings about this, I guess.
Yeah, but because they're so close and convenient, I think that's what I'm going to lose.
Yeah,
haven't had a rental car in 15 years or whatever.
I'm making up for you then.
Yeah.
We rented one when everybody drove up to Michigan. I don't even know where my mom picked up the rental car from, though. Other than that, having multiple cars means you rarely have to rent a car.
Well, we used to rent cars when we were younger just to go on vacations and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it was my dad who said, yeah, let's just put the mileage on someone else's car.
Yeah,
right.
That's smart.
So, right.
And if it does have any mechanical issue, they bring you another one.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it is cheap insurance, basically.
So you're not a fan of Enterprise?
No, not really. Plus, and I don't mean to cast too strong aspersion, but a lot of the times their staff don't impress me that much either. I actually interviewed with them many, many years ago, and I got the impression that it was kind of that everybody who works for them is in some kind of twisted manager trainee program, and they're all kind of bucking for salesperson of the year.
Well, that's the other, I mean, we're coming at this from opposite angles here, because I've been impressed with some of the people that I've met, and I recognize that they do this management trainee thing, and some of those kids, I'm going to call them kids, and I know that's insulting, but some of those kids work really hard to get that.
Sure.
I shouldn't
say that as a blanket thing, but it's just been my impression. Yeah, my challenge to Enterprise, you know, clean your cars. That will, if you do that alone, that will just improve your business so much.
All right.
And don't you use weird deodorizers or what have you. I know a lot of places attempt to make their cars smell better and only make it smell horrific. My kid was pointing that out. I went out car looking with one of my kids, and every car he got into, because it was overwhelming, the fragrance they put in these cars. And it's just, you know.
It's the automotive equivalent of a GI shower.
All right, next topic on the list is my turbo question mark thing. So I was watching television, and it was a Wheeler Dealer thing where the new guy, Ant Anstead, he was describing the mechanics, the mechanisms of a turbo for the people who don't know how to work them, how they function. And then he wraps up his whole speech with the phrase, every car should have one. And I thought that was a pretty bold thing to say, right? Because on the one hand, I do see the case that he's making in terms of what a turbo does for an engine. But still, we look around and very few cars, percentage-wise, actually have them overall. So I raised the question to us, should every car have a turbo?
No.
Eric had previously brought up the point of a lot of people don't know
how to own a turbo.
Right. I was going to say how to drive a turbo. It's a little iffy saying it that way. But
and we have talked about this on mic before. We've briefly touched on it, but I wanted to
deal with it. But not the idea of every car, why every car should have one, according to this person.
Well, if cars are disposable now, which they are, then yeah, that's great. Because turbos do not add longevity, they take it.
But why not touch on the benefits of what a turbo would do for a car, as opposed to just saying that maybe other people don't know what benefits it would bring?
You get over 100% volumetric efficiency, but it takes away from longevity.
Hold on, because I need an ELI 5 on that, but Ronnie's been trying to.
I think a good thing to bring up is how a turbo actually works, or what it is, for those of our listeners that don't know what it is. Ultimately, a turbo is a compressor housing that uses the exhaust gas from the engine to spin a compressor that forces air back into the intake, because one of the limiting factors of an engine is how much air it can bring in. We can always dump fuel into an engine to get an explosion. We can always create a bigger spark, but getting enough air to reach what we call stoichiometric efficiency, which I can't pronounce properly, I apologize. Ultimately, it's 14.7 parts of air to one part of fuel is what your optimal explosion ratio is. So you can get the fuel all you want, but you won't be able to get the air to match unless you have something forcing air in, which is what a turbo does. Superchargers work on a similar principle. Instead of using the exhaust gas, it's a compressor that runs off of a belt, which is driven off of your crankshaft pulley. So you get air forced in that way. The conversation would be, yes, it increases efficiency, so you can you get more power out of it. As Eric said, you get higher volumetric efficiency. Normally an engine runs off of a vacuum. It depends on the piston sucking air in to the combustion chamber. With a turbocharger, the turbo forces the air in. So vacuums pull in a good amount of air. Turbos make sure you have all the air in the cylinder. So now that you know what a turbo is, we can continue that conversation.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of even making it even more basic, just in case some listener doesn't really get it. Because it's not the gas itself that explodes, I guess it's the vapor. So that's really why the air is so important. It's not the liquid, it's when it's vaporizing, and that's why the air is so very important to that mixture.
Well, you need the oxygen, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. But a lot of people really think it's the liquid portion of it, but it's like not smoking at the gas station. They don't realize it's the vapor.
Yeah, right. Cigarettes go out in gasoline. The vapors burn.
Right.
Right. So does that explain what the benefit of a turbo is?
Yeah. You can increase the efficiency of an engine over what it naturally can do by forcing more air. Therefore, you can add more fuel and make more power. But
and the downside is?
You're taking the life of that engine and shortening it. There's a buddy of mine used to say, your engine's going to make this much horsepower in its lifetime. How you make it and to what extent determines the life of that engine.
Well, what if they're not looking at it from a power perspective, but just an efficiency perspective?
Yeah.
They're not looking to push
the most efficient my turbo car ever was, I drove from the BP in Buckhead to the Florida State line on 5 gallons of gas by watching the boost gauge never go over zero.
See, I would think a supercharger would be more efficient over a turbocharger. Not talking about power, just talking about efficiency, because wouldn't a supercharger deliver cooler air?
Depending on how
it's set up, maybe?
No, it's still compressing, takes X amount of heat, and puts it in a smaller space.
Yeah.
Yeah, compression always makes heat because your molecules are bouncing harder against each other.
Hard bounces.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And to give a little historical perspective here, where their efficiency really works is at high altitude. I mean, these devices were originally developed for aircraft.
Right.
Which, you know, operate way high where the air is very thin. So, you know, yeah.
You need more air.
Right. I used to have a VW GTI with a turbo, and I lived in Texas at the time, 600 feet above sea level. No, 300 feet above sea level. Okay, yeah, it made some nice punch when I hit it. But then I took it on a trip up to Colorado one time, and it really shone up there. You know, I could drive around like James Bond, and I was getting, you know, mileage like a Corolla because it was improving that efficiency in the thin air up in the mountains.
James Bond and a Corolla.
Quite a picture when you think about it.
I don't think Bond ever had a Corolla.
But so, Eric, you're saying something like it reduces the life expectancy of the engine overall, but is that simply because of heat issues, or people just don't know how to maintain it?
Well, that also, the big issue, so many of them now, you see, they all smoke because people don't know how to own a turbo. When you come off full throttle, your turbo is spinning 150, 200,000 RPM, and as soon as you shut the engine off in your driveway, it's still spinning. And, yeah, you just killed the oil supply and the coolant supply. See, mostly the oil supply is the big one.
So if you do have a turbo,
let it idle.
For how long?
I used to do it. I'd coast into my neighborhood. I figured out the amount of speed, so it was a couple minutes. 30 seconds even helps.
So sit in your driveway or garage, give it a minute at idle.
And just be easy on it when you're coming into. If you know you're going to park it in a minute, don't romp on it. Don't go wide open. Try to, you know, just easy on the throttle as you can.
Don't screech into the parking space.
Yeah, it's a, like I said, that's a lot of spinning for no oil.
Sorry. From the tuner scene, we had these things called turbo timers, yes. Which were inline modules where you would turn the car off, take the key out, and the turbo timer would leave the car idling for whatever amount of time that you set it to. Oh. Typically, we set it for 1 to 3 minutes, and I saw recently on new BMWs, the new M240, not new, it was a 2017 model. There's a button that says automatic off. It's a little A with a circle around it. You press that button when you leave the car. You take the key with you, you lock the doors, and the car will stay running for about 1 minute to 1 minute 30 seconds. I believe the engine computer will monitor oil temps and coolant temps to make sure that everything reduces to a satisfying level. The car will eventually turn off on its own after it feels all the engine components have cooled down enough.
Okay, now, just because I don't know, the round start-stop button, directly below it, a squarish button that says A off.
Mm-hmm.
What I've come across on that is the start-stop override, where you come to a stop and your engine shuts off, which is just the best idea in the world for killing starters. Because BMW starters never do it. but the start-stop button, that is the override underneath it. So I don't know. I don't know if on the turbo models, does that work as a turbo timer is beautiful. If they did that, that's phenomenal. Because BMW, the people that don't, when your electric water pump goes bad, they don't tell you because it did set a code, but they don't tell you until it overheats.
Right.
They could have told you it just failed, let's get out of the way. But so the fact that they did a turbo timer on their turbo, I did not know that. That's wonderful.
That's the impression I got. I haven't gotten feedback or anything from engineering, but okay. I did know that when I was working with BMW back in 2010, we did have tremendous turbo problems because people didn't know how to handle a turbo.
Yes.
Like, for one thing, that's a direct injection issue, so I won't even bring that up.
Yeah.
Turbos would fail because they wouldn't change their oil on time. BMW engineers were convinced that you can have oil changes every 15 to 20,000 miles on a turbo vehicle.
Yeah.
You may be able to pull that off on an NA car. Oil technology has evolved greatly. However, the problem is our fuel quality is extraordinarily low. So when you have, you know, a $70,000 turbo car and you're getting $2 gas from Kroger, there's contaminants in there that will actually affect the longevity of your oil. Also, it should be known that any chemical or any fluid in your vehicle breaks down exponentially faster with increased heat. So if you have oil flowing through this 1,000-degree turbocharger,
yes,
the oil breaks down faster. You have contaminants from your fuel that make it even dirtier, and you're lucky to make it last 10,000 miles, if that. Typically, what I would recommend, and I would recommend this to customers that ask me about it, I would say change your oil every 7,500 miles. With synthetic, depending on your driving conditions, if you romp on your car, if you're really hard on it, change it every 5,000 miles. But if you're just cruising on the highway, 7,500 should be fine.
So yeah. Quick poll and we'll wrap up this topic.
Mm-hmm.
Just real quick around the table, one at a time. Should every engine have a turbo? Why or why not? 30 seconds, Ben.
I would say no, because, well, they're great for a lot of things. They really aren't necessary for everything.
Right.
No, because one, they cost too much. Two, they're too hard to maintain. So without a proper educational course for everyone that decides to own a turbo, it's not worthwhile. And three, all you're really doing is making more power, which most people don't need. You don't get increased fuel efficiency.
Yeah, a lot of people don't need Becca. Extra power. I would say no. The advantages of it just doesn't outweigh the issues.
Yes, I'm right there with everybody. No, turbos have a place, usually on a diesel.
And I don't have a firm opinion on this matter, but, you know, four of you guys disagreeing with at instead of Wheeler Dealers, so, Ant, give us a call. We'd love to talk further about this with you on the show. Let's do Ronnie. Ronnie wrote up how to appreciate your mechanic or appreciating your mechanic. Ronnie.
Yeah, so this is for all you customers that keep saying the customer is always right. Yes, we love you, customers. You are very valuable to us. You keep our business afloat, and we thank you for that. However, there is something that you need to realize, that there are those of us that are trying to be good people, that are trying to save you money, and that are trying to give you every scenario that we can. When you try to turn on us in such a way that we get stuck between a rock and a hard place, it's tough to make the customer right when we're dealing with things that you don't see.
So give us an example when the customer puts you between a rock and a hard place. What's that mean?
So the current situation that I'm working on a customer's transmission, a manual transmission on a Scion XB. Great customer, but she ran into an issue with a previous shop that didn't do a good job. They replaced the transmission, didn't make sure it was right, and they sent her along her way. The manual transmission that they put in was just as bad as the first one they took out. And it's just a known problem for those vehicles. So what I recommended is that we send the transmission out to get rebuilt, because you know what you're working with at that point. If you replace the internals with new components, then you have a solid transmission. So we did that. However, once I take it out and send it off to a vendor, the car is out of my hands. There's very little that I can do in terms of costs and all that kind of stuff. The vendor has put me off for 2 weeks now, and the transmission is out of my hands, and there's very little I can do, and the customer has been contacting me about discounts and pushing and so on and so forth. And the thing with mechanics, we're not typically the most sociable of people. There's a very specific way to talk to mechanics, and there's a very limited range in which mechanics can communicate.
And the rest of us around the table are kind of laughing at this.
We're really good at talking with our hands, and there's a small handful of us that really know how to use our words.
It's learning how like they inflict their grunts and snorts.
Say again, Becca?
It's kind of like a savant thing. It's, you know, they're their own people. Yes, there's a specific way.
Right. So they work in very simple tones, and they work in very simple words. If we are working very hard to get you something, and we are being honest with you, and we say, I'm sorry, but this is really the situation that we're dealing with, you got to have a little bit of patience and grace with them, because cars have just become a really weird thing to deal with. And it's not like it was back in the 70s, 80s, or 90s, where literally everything was replaceable and parts were everywhere. We're working with computer systems and vendors that say they specialize in something, but parts aren't available because the profit margins aren't there.
So it sounds like that you, even as a mechanic, are getting impatient with the way the world has changed fixing cars. And this is happening simultaneously as your customers getting impatient and frustrated because they're waiting on you, you're waiting on someone else. The whole thing has been sort of...
Right.
They can't fix every component of the car. People have become more the fast food type of society where everything is hurry up, do it now. The mechanics have to send things out more often. But as a side note, I completely understand what he's saying. A lot of people who don't know anything about cars, there are so many horrible mechanics out there. They're either bad at what they do, or they're so busy selling step-ups or whatever like that. And a lot of people that don't know about cars, they don't know what's right, what's accurate. They don't know who's trying to pull one over and who is honestly trying to.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's Yelp, but, you know. It's really difficult.
So when you said terrible mechanics, that's when Eric raised his hand. And
well, no, like, I just yes, I am a horrible mechanic.
No, come on.
No, I'm kidding.
But I did say the Holly and Select last night. Sorry, but no, the customer's always right. I had an old school manager once said, "No, right is always right." This industry used to be a skilled trade. Mm-hmm. It is now a service industry. A customer will come in and say, I need all this work done, but I have to have it by 4. Well, that's not how it works. You need all this work done. If you want it done properly, I work quickly. I like to think I'm a decent mechanic, and I'm very efficient at what I do. You have to give me the time to fix your car right.
But the customer isn't educated on what it takes to repair right, that part.
That's, and they need to be willing to be educated by me or another mechanic that's willing to take the time and say, this is what your car needs. I will tell you the priorities of what needs to be done first. What is the safety issue? What is secondary?
That classic sign that we've all seen in the mechanic shop, you can have your car done good, fast, or cheap, pick two.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So how then do we appreciate our mechanics?
So I think something that I've come across and that I used to host at BMW was what we call after sales educational courses, which is a course on knowing your car after you've purchased it in terms of maintenance and all those kinds of things. Again, I'm going to say it's a little bit difficult because not all mechanics are well versed in communications. You know, when a guy walks up to you with a dirty air filter not from your car and says, well, hot dang, you know, someone's trying to build a chipmunk nest right up in your air filter here, so we're going to have to replace that and $20, you know.
And you have a terrible southern accent.
Well, I don't know. Who's doing all right?
That was all right, actually. That sounded like a real mechanic I work with.
Yeah, it's a mechanic southern accent, yes. Not a normal southern accent.
Yes.
It's difficult to get away from those. If you can't understand what your mechanic is saying and they can't give it to you in solid ABCs, you probably shouldn't follow them, but you have to do your own due diligence and follow your own service records. However, if you found that magical mechanic that your family trusts, your friends trust, they have honestly said, I'm sorry, I can't help you because I don't know what's wrong. There's specialists that I can recommend. If they recommend other people because they know that they have reached a limit, that is a good mechanic. Just appreciate them. Thank them for their honesty. Thank them for the time that they're willing to put in, because there's many times that we mechanics will look at something and spend hours on something, and we will not find anything fixable, and we say, sorry, we came up dry, don't worry about paying for anything. But that's 6 hours out of our day that we're not getting paid for.
Yes. Right, and that was just crossing my mind, something that you should point out, how mechanics generally get paid.
100% commission.
Yeah, so there's this system called flat rate. We have a book, technically, All Data, Mitchell, and I think Reynolds is another system that we follow in terms of a price guide. The book has your make and model, and we look that up, and then we look up the job. So if we're replacing a water pump, we look at the book, and we say for a 2000 Pontiac Sunfire, the book says 2.2 hours to replace the water pump. No matter what, whether we take half an hour or 6 hours, we charge you 2.2 hours plus parts, supplies, tax, whatever. So if that water pump has rusted bolts, or we accidentally snap a bolt because it's been corroded and it's stuck in the block, and we spend the next 3 days drilling and tapping that bolt out, we're still only charging you 2.2 hours of labor. So we just lost a ton of time and a ton of money. Now, there are places that will supplement that somehow, but typically,
depends on where you work.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that book is there to protect the customer, because if it takes me the first time I do a job a whole day to do a 2-hour job, I can't charge you that 8 to 10 hours that I spent on it. Right. I have to charge you the 2 hours that it's supposed to take. It's there for their protection, for consistency throughout the industry, nationwide, worldwide, whatever.
And so you're not even saying that in order to thank a mechanic or to appreciate a mechanic, you're not even saying that donuts or beignets are even needed.
No. No. It doesn't have to be coffee.
Just be a good customer.
Yeah. So being
say thank you.
Yeah. Say thank you. Appreciate them. Send them customers that aren't saying, oh, well, I found this guy up the street that'll do it for half the price.
Yes.
And please, I had a lady call me.
Then go do that.
Oh, my gosh. This drove me nuts. A lady called me off of a referral. She said, oh, this person told me to call you. I'm looking to get my convertible top on my BMW replaced. I've said, oh, I'm sorry, I really don't do convertible top work. I can replace the motor. I can look into diagnosing if there's a problem. She said, no, I want the whole thing done. I said, okay, I can refer you to a friend who does this kind of stuff. He's a body shop. He does excellent work. He works on high-end cars. Let me text him real quick. Texted my buddy. He gave me a general quote estimate. Ladies and gentlemen, estimates mean a roundabout number. It doesn't mean that's going to be the number. Could right. be higher, could be lower. He said estimate of $1,500. I forward the information to the lady. The lady says, oh, well, I came across this shop that said they would do it for $1,100. Okay.
That is less.
That's great, ma'am. What would you like me to do? She said, well, I want you to beat it. I said, well, I'm not doing the work. I got the information for you from a friend. And if you feel more comfortable with the quality of work that $1,100 will bring you, then go for the $1,100. But I can say out of experience that my friend has done this a number of times, and probably a better idea to go with the $1,500 rather than trying to save yourself a little bit of money now and then spend way more later on just trying to get it done right at all.
Yeah. That's the thing. I think many of us are sort of programmed to be super bargain hunters on all kinds of services, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you have someone like Double C Becca, who's not here at the moment, but you know, she can find the sweetest deal on any number of things. On the other hand, maybe that's not always the right approach. So
sometimes you get what you pay for.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go. I mean, sometimes it all comes down to that. A lot of times it's comparing what's included in that cost, how far into the work, you know, if you're having something rebuilt, you know, how much or how detailed they're doing it. A lot of things that go into cars really is an art form. So are you getting somebody who's an artist, or are you getting somebody who's just doing a job? You know, it depends.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. Becca, you want to talk about your fuse real quick?
I don't know if it was going to be really quick. It was mostly, I know y'all had seen the picture that I'd posted. There is this odd, and I use the quotes around it, the word fuse. GM refers to it as a fuse. It's on my Pontiac G8 / Holden Commodore, that it's on the positive battery terminal. Mm-hmm. There is a main cable, and then there is this device that leads to two wires and goes through what I can best describe as 260-amp A&L fuses, but it's this one little box. I think it's more like a distribution box.
Mm-hmm.
Through all my issues trying to get the Pontiac to someone who was willing to do the 15 labor hours for the oil pump, which I now discovered that now my alternator has just stopped working, apparently, and he had suggested that possibly it's this air quote fuse causing the issue. After looking into it, discovering, shockingly, this part too has been discontinued. A lot of the parts that are needed on the G8 have been discontinued. Most of the time, GM does not give you an alternate part. Sometimes they'll help you out and they'll say, here, try this part out instead, or I've tried every distributor that I could. Everybody is saying it's gone. Nobody is offering solutions. I know Ronnie had seen one apparently going in the most current Mustang, apparently. I don't have a lot of experience with the newer ones, mm-hmm. but... So I decided to jerry-rig it. So I built my own distribution. What are we going to call it? I don't know. Basically, I just got some new eyelets, some new wire, and I chose to route it through circuit breakers instead. I had looked at A&L fuses, things like that.
I mean, I know you do your homework, and I know you probably searched for parts pretty exhaustively. It kind of shocks me that there's not a replacement or there's a word I'm looking for, an upgrade.
Right. Yeah, something comparable or, yeah.
Something superseded it. That's the word yes. I'm looking for.
I wasn't able to, and I thought about chasing what Ronnie had sent, but at the same time, electrical is kind of my wheelhouse anyways, and the idea of having something that I could reset over having to track down if this was a problem part, sounded like a much better alternative. Because with the circuit breaker, when it blows, you just reset it. You don't have to replace it. So,
yeah. Car Stereo Supplies is actually a good monster. I've used their stuff to replace battery terminals. They make phenomenally nice. And you can get all the gauges you need. You can get specific blocks with heavy gauge to small gauge wiring and make your own distribution block with good quality fuses, wires, parts.
Oh, so no, as an alternative, I have a good source for my parts. I guess I'll do a new plug, CE Auto Electric Supply. I kind of want to keep them to myself. And the beautiful part, you can get even 2-gauge wire that's flexible.
Mm.
Awesome.
Wow.
But, no, it was just the concept of I'd like to be able to reset this. So I go through all this trouble. I have my ABS plastic sheet, and I'm, started by gluing down just to test out area and then, screwing down and doing all my crimps and solders and this and that. So it apparently does function. All the electricity is flowing. Nothing is tripping. Everything's beautiful, but the alternator is still not turning back on. So
something is happening between the fuse and the alternator.
Right. So, as far as I can answer your question right now, I don't even remember specific. I don't even remember what everything was testing at as far as numbers. Pretty much what I'm remembering at this point is that it was flowing, things were functioning, nothing was tripping. I mean, I can go back and get specific numbers, but it's not.
When we've all had a little more sleep and we're not recording at 2:00 in the morning, maybe that's.
I think a few of us have had some
rough
nights recently. So.
Yeah. Well, shall we call it a day then?
Sounds like it.
Yeah, we've covered a lot in this particular session. I think it's time for lunch.
Yeah.
All right, let's get out of here. This is The Thing About Cars. Thank you, as always, for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you guys. If you have questions or comments or feedback or input on anything that we've ever talked about, please find us on our new website. That's thethingaboutcars.com.
Thethingaboutcars.com.
And failing that, you can always find us on Facebook, but we have this really slick website that Suzanne put together for us, and we'll have to show that off. So find us there. As always, just be safe out there, and we will see you guys soon. Take care.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.